See everybody in the right part of the only giant. I think we better start now with the formalities, the apology of the Ngabadeli, Honorable Ngabadeli, and the Ali still stand. They are both sick. The Honorable Santo is overseas. The Honorable Professor Ndababa is attending a court matter in KZN. The Honorable Loretta Jacobus is busy with undersight work. I'm not sure. I understand the Honorable Swart also won't be here today. And also Honorable Abrasini. The Honorable Chabalang is attending a workshop for new chairpersons, an induction workshop for new chairpersons. Those are the apologies. I know the Honorable Mentor had inquired about the venue and we had informed her and she had undertaken to be here, so I take it she's still on the way. I'm sure that all the Honorable Members have a document which has been circulated by Mr. Daniels' department, is that correct? Is there anybody that doesn't have the document? I understand that this is the document that is going to be presented by the Mr. Daniels' office. Everything I see is set out there, the reasons and so on, so we won't go into that, but yesterday we did give Mr. Daniels, or did undertake to give us an opinion on certain matters, and this is what we are here for today. Just to remind those Honorable Members that have not been here, we are still busy looking at that very important aspect of the bill, and that is to try and harmonize the bill with PIA, the Promotion of Access to Information Act. And we have been since last year busy with those particular clauses in the bill and looking at PIA. We have developed two documents, or rather the office of Mr. Daniels has developed two documents, Working Document 1 and Working Document 2. And the idea was to look at one system through which access to information would be requested, and another system whereby both the bill and PIA could be used to access information that has been classified. We're still busy with that process now. Mr. Daniel's office is still busy assisting us in trying to look at the various clauses and the various options. Mr. Daniel's is going to present to us an opinion on one of the matters that was put in yesterday. And if it is okay with you, Mr. Daniels, I'd like to hand over to you.
Chairperson, thank you, and good morning to you and the members and others. Chairperson, we have indeed managed to prepare an opinion, and if you don't mind, I'll ask my colleagues, Sisa Makubeni and Ms. Wiyokazi Mkubezi, to handle the matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We were requested to look at three questions, Chairperson. The first one was whether legislation can provide for a dual system of access to information under the Protection of the Information Bill and one other under the Access to Information Act. which can withstand the constitutional challenge. The second question was whether a classifying person under the Protection of Information Bill can also be the information officer, can be the same person as the information officer under the Protection of Information, of Access to Information Act, the Promotion of Access to Information Act, considers the request for access to information. And the third question was whether which organs of state the Protection of Information Bill applies to. I will start with the first two questions, and my colleague Vyogas will handle the third question. On whether legislation can provide for a dual system of access to information, which is properly aligned under the promotion, the Protection of Information Bill and the Promotion of Access to Information Act, that can withstand a constitutional challenge. The Constitutional Court, in the case of Investigating Directorate, Serious Offences and Others, versus Sunday, Motor Distributors, stated that judicial officers must prefer interpretations of legislation that fall within constitutional bounds over those that do not, provided that such an interpretation can reasonably be ascribed to a section. Limits must, however, be placed on the application of this principle. On the one hand, it is the duty of a judicial officer to interpret legislation in conformity with the Constitution, so insofar as that is reasonably possible. On the other hand, the legislature has a duty to pass legislation that is reasonably clear and precise, enabling citizens and officials to understand what is expected of them. A balance will therefore have to be struck as to how this tension is to be resolved when considering the constitutionality of legislation. There will be occasions when a judicial officer will find that legislation, even though it's open to a meaning which would be unconstitutional, is reasonably capable of being read in conformity with the Constitution. Such an interpretation should, however, be not unduly strained. Also, in Affordable Medicines Trust and Others versus Minister of Health, Maboche, as even was stated, the doctrine of vagueness is one of the principles of common law that was developed by the court to regulate the exercise of public power. The exercise of public power is now regulated by the Constitution, which is the supreme law. The doctrine of vagueness is founded on the rule of law, which is the foundational value of our constitutional democracy. It requires that laws must be written in a clear and accessible manner. What is required is a reasonable certainty and not perfect lucidity. The doctrine of vagueness does not require absolute certainty of laws. The law must indicate with reasonable certainty to those who are bound by it what is required of them, so that they may regulate their conduct accordingly. The doctrine of vagueness must recognize the role of government to further legitimate social and economic objectives, and should not be used unduly to impede or prevent the furtherance of such objectives. The two cases we've referred to require that legislation should be reasonably clear and precise, and they should legislation should enable citizens and officials to understand what is expected of them. It would therefore be necessary, with regard to the question that is asked, to ensure that the provisions of the Protection of Information Bill are reasonably clear and precise, to enable citizens and officials to understand what is expected of them. The provisions of the Promotion of Access to Information Act indicate that that act was never intended to be the only legislation in terms of which access to information may be granted. Section 5 of the Promotion of Access to Information Act provides that PAIA applies to the exclusion of any provision of other legislation that prohibits or restricts the disclosure of a record of a public or a private body and is materially inconsistent with the object of a specific provision of PAIA. Section 6 of PAIA provides that nothing in PAIA prevents the giving of access to a record of a public body in terms of any legislation referred to in part one of the schedule to prior, or a record of a private body in terms of any legislation referred to in part two of the schedule to prior. It is therefore a policy decision that the committee would need to take whether to provide for a dual system of access to information, one under the Promotion of Access to Information Act, and the other under the bill. There is nothing constitutional that prevents the legislature from granting dual access in this way, but it may have unintended consequences. It may result in a kind of forum shopping where people seek access first in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act, and then seek access in terms of the bill once it's passed into legislation, thereby increasing the administrative burden on the officials of organs of state. Officials of organs of state may also be confused as to which legislation to apply in what instance if access may be requested under both PAIA and the Protection of Information Bill. Providing for access to information requests under the Protection of Information Bill to be made under PAIA and cross-referencing that act for all access-related matters in the bill means that the Protection of Information Bill will then deal with the classification and declassification of information and other information protection provisions, and then access would only be dealt with under PAIA. The other thing that the committee would need to take into consideration if it pursues the route of giving dual access would be that under Section 5 of PAIA, there is a schedule that is provided for there. So the committee would need to go through a process of consulting with the Minister of Justice and having that schedule amended to include the Protection of Information Bill there, to cater for access under this legislation. Coming to the second question, whether classifying person under the Protection of Information Bill can also be the information officer under PAIA who considers a request for access to information. We start by looking at who is the information officer under PAIA. PAIA defines the information officer as follows: the information officer of or in relation to a public body, in case of a national department, provincial administration or organizational component mentioned in column 1 of schedule 1 or 3 of the Public Service Act, means the officer who is the incumbent of a post bearing the designation mentioned in column 2 of the schedule 1 or 3. Opposite the name of the relevant national department, provincial administration, or organizational component, or the person who is acting as such. If the person is not so mentioned, it means the director general, head, executive director, or equivalent officer, respectively, of the national department, provincial administration, or organizational component, or a person acting as such. In the case of a municipality, it means a municipal manager appointed in terms of Section 82 of the Local Government Municipal Structures Act 1998, or a person acting in that position. In the case of any other public body, it means the chief executive officer or an equivalent officer of that public body or a person acting in that capacity. Column 2 of Schedule 1 and 3 to the Public Service Act lists heads of national departments, provincial administration, or organizational components. Section 17 of PAIA provides that each public body must, subject to legislation governing the employment of personnel of the public body concerned, designate such number of persons as deputy information officers as are necessary to render the public body as accessible as reasonably possible for request of its records. Section 17.2 provides that the information officer of the public body has direction and control over every deputy information officer of that body. Subsection 3 empowers the information officer of a public body to delegate a power or duty conferred or imposed on that information officer by prior to a deputy information officer of that public body. Section 17.6 provides that any delegation in terms of Section 3 must be in writing and does not prohibit the person who made the delegation from exercising the power or performing a duty himself or herself, and may at any time be withdrawn or amended in writing. How classification operates at present. In terms of current practice, under the minimum information security standards document, classification is done by the head of department or a person authorized to act on his or her behalf, who prepares, generates, or initially classifies, or has a document classified. In the MIS document, that person is referred to as the author of the document. In terms of the MIS, the responsibility for grading and regrading of document classifications rests with the Department of State where the document have their origin. And the function there rests with the author or the head of the Department of State or his or her delegate. Whether the information officer should be the same as the classifying person. In our view, it is a policy decision that will depend on the circumstances of each organ of state. In certain instances, the information officer may be designated as the classifying person, but not necessarily the classifying person, as this would be the author of the document. The decision would, amongst others, depend on the security clearance that the person has and whether they can lawfully have access to the information that is classified. The decision regarding who declassifies information in a particular organ of state is a decision that should be left to the head of an organ of state. To ensure that the decision on who classifies is exercised properly, the bill may require that each head of an organ of state establish a written policy for his or her department or organ of state, depending on the circumstances of that department and the security clearance that is required. In addition, the information officer would, if different from the classifying officer or was not the author of the document, need to work hand in hand with the designated declassifying officer in considering a request for access. This is, however, not the level of detail that should be contained in legislation. It should suffice in the legislation to say that the information officer must, where he or she decides to grant access to a record, have it declassified. So it will be an internal working process that the department will carry out on how the document is declassified. In President of the Republic of South Africa versus the Mail and Guardian Media, a case that was decided in the Supreme Court of Appeal in December last year, the court stated that it can be expected that an information officer or other officials of a public body will most often not have direct knowledge of facts that are material to justifying secrecy, and will necessarily be reliant upon documents and other hearsay sources. The court pointed out that Section 3 of the Law of Evidence Amendment Act, number 45 of 1998, gives the court a wide discretion to admit hearsay evidence, and liberal use of that section is quite capable of overcoming difficulties that might be encountered by a public body in that regard. So this indicates that it is possible for the information officer of a public body to obtain facts that are material to justifying secrecy from another officer who could be the declassifying officer. It is our view, therefore, that it is possible for the information officer to be a classifying person where he or she is the author of a document or a head of an organ of state. When, for instance, the delegation is made to an information officer that is not the author of a document, it may not be desirable that they be the classifying authority, as the author should remain the classifying authority for practical reasons. How can those states normally operate in a bureaucratic or hierarchical environment, where routing of documents from author to person granting approval necessarily passes through the hands of a number of persons? It would therefore defeat the very purpose of classification if persons who do not have the requisite security clearance would first have sight of documents in the routing process. Can access to documents be refused on the basis of classification under PIA? In our consideration, we've said the answer to this question is no. The only grounds that that can be given for refusal of access to a record of a public body are those that are contained in PIA. Section 11 of PIA provides that a requester must be given access to a record of a public body if that requester complies with all the procedural requirements in that act relating to a request for access to that record. And access to that record is not refused in terms of any ground for refusal contemplated in Chapter 4 of Part 2 of PIA. Sections 34 to 45 of PIA provide for mandatory and discretionary grounds for refusal of access to a record of a public body. The grounds of refusal are subject to a limited public interest override in Section 46 and severability as contained in Section 28 of PIA. The PIA public interest override is limited to information that discloses evidence of a breach of law or a serious risk to public safety or the environment. Section 28 of PIA provides that if a request for access is made to a record of a public body containing information which may or must be refused in terms of any provision of Section 34 to 45, every part of the record which does not contain and can reasonably be severed from any part that contains any such information must, despite any other provision of PIA, be disclosed. And the President of the Republic of South Africa versus Mail and Guardian, the case that we referred to earlier of the Supreme Court of Appeal, the court stated that a request for information that is held by a public body obliges the information officer to produce it unless he or she can justify withholding it. The court held that if the information officer refuses a request, then adequate reasons for the refusal must be stated. So an information officer cannot just give the classification of the document as a reason. There would have to be adequate reasons given. Then there would need to be a reference to the provisions of the Promotion of Access to Information Act that are relied upon to refuse the request. And then the court further pointed out that in court proceedings under Section 78(2) of PIA, proof that a record has been requested and declined is enough to oblige the public body to justify its refusal in terms of Section 813 of PIA. In our view, the classification of records is there to assist officials of departments in ensuring that documents are protected from unauthorized alteration, destruction, disclosure, or loss. This ensures that only persons who have the relevant security clearance have access to classified documents outside of the procedure provided for in PIA. Once a request is made under PIA, that request must be considered in light of the provisions of that Act and granted or refused in accordance with that Act. If a record is classified, then discretion would need to be exercised by the information officer on whether or not to grant access. And if a decision is taken to grant access, then the record would need to be declassified. We have already referred to the provisions of Sections 5 and 6 of PIA above, on the application of PIA and other legislation. I will now hand over to my colleague.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll be dealing with question number 3, in our opinion, which deals with which organs of state the Protection of Information Bill applies to. Clause 3 of the Protection of Information Bill provides that the bill applies to all organs of state. The Protection of Information Bill defines organ of state as any organ of state as defined in Section 239 of the Constitution, including any public entity defined in Section 1 of the Public Finance Management Act of 1999 and Section 3 of the Municipal Finance Management Act of 2003, and any facility or installation declared as a national key point in terms of the National Key Points Act of 1980. The definition of organ of state found in Section 239 of the Constitution is as follows. Organ of state means any department of state or administration in the national, provincial, or local sphere of government, or any other functionary or institution exercising a power or performing a function in terms of the constitution or a provincial constitution, or exercising a public power or performing a public function in terms of any legislation, but does not include a court or a judicial officer. In COF versus Health Professions Council of South Africa of 2000, a Transvaal Supreme Court decision, it was held that when there is a question of whether an institution, especially the ones that are outside the public services, are organs of state or not, the test that was laid in Directory Advertising Cost Cutters versus Minister for Post Telecommunications and Broadcasting of 1996 needs to be applied. The test is a control test. The case that I referred to earlier is the case that was decided when the constitution was still the interim constitution. The question that will have to be asked will be whether the ultimate control of that entity ultimately vests in the state and whether that entity performs a public function. There is then a need to look deeper into the meaning of exercising a public body or performing a public function, which is the second leg of the test. An attempt is made to define it on page 315 in the case of COF referred to above. The meaning is engaged in the affairs of services of the public. That meaning was taken directly from the Concise Oxford Dictionary. Duval and Curry et al., the Bill of Rights Handbook on page 39, states that a functionary or an institution qualifies as an organ of state in terms of Section 239 of the Constitution when it exercises a public power or performs a public function in terms of legislation. This provision means, firstly, that the functionary or the institution must derive powers from a statute or perform a function in terms of a statute, as opposed to merely being incorporated pursuant to a statute, such as all companies and corporate constitutions are, and closed corporations are. And secondly, that the power or function must be of a public nature. In Inkatha Freedom Party versus Truth and Reconciliation Commission, 2000 case, it was held that an organ of state for the purposes of Section 32(1) of the Constitution dealing with freedom of information includes functionaries and institutions which, though not part of the government, exercise powers which are considered to be of a public nature. Consequently, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was held to be an organ of state, even though it was not under the direct control of government. It was found to be an entity created by statute and designed to fulfill the objectives outlined in the postscript to the interim constitution and the preamble to the Promotion of National Unity and Reconciliation Act of 1995. In view of the provisions of Clause 3 of the Protection of Information Bill, its provisions apply to all organs of state as defined in the bill. Thank you.
Daniel, do you want to add?
No, Chairperson, thank you. But the last question, of course, demonstrates our difficulty it is for us at short notice to provide Honorable Maney with a detailed list of organs of state which may be affected by the bill in question. Thanks.
Honorable members, there is the opinion supported by the necessary court decisions. Perhaps we deal with the easier one first, and that's the organs of state. Because I see the Honorable Mania, there's not much debate there except to say that it is a, from what I hear now from the opinion, that it is a liquid thing. It can change shape from day to day depending on what bodies might come into existence on a particular day and disappear on another day, such as the TRC. It's no longer in existence, but was held to be an organ of state. seems that organized states, in terms of what we've been told, is not a permanent, not necessary, a permanent thing. One just wonders whether these commissions that get tasked by the executive perhaps don't also fall in that category, but voice an opinion on that. I think what Mr. Daniel's office is saying, there isn't a closed category of organs of state, a defined category where you can say, well, on last count, there were 2,561. I think what Mr. Daniels' office is saying is that some of them still, there is doubt, and these things very often have to be decided by the courts as to whether they are in fact an organ of state or not. So I'm not sure, Mr. Honourable Mania, whether that has answered your question, but let's debate that one first, and then we'll go on to the more complex one, and that is the mandatory relating to PAYA.
Chair, I raised the issue precisely, I think, because of the fact that, as you say, the definition is liquid, and that the implication of that, of course, gives the minister very wide powers. But my understanding is that Mr. Daniel will now compile such a schedule so that our committee can proceed from the basis of fact, and so that at least within the bounds of the definition, we can get a schedule of organs of state. If there's doubt about a particular organ of state, then perhaps that could be indicated by Mr. Daniel. But I do believe that we have to proceed and debate the application of this bill on the basis of fact.
In Romania, you seem to be asking the Chief State Law Advisor to go count the grains of sand in the Sahara Desert. But perhaps I'm being too harsh. Honourable,
if I may just pick up from my a colleague there. It is important to see before us a list of what it is we're talking about. In the first place, because of the grains of sand aspect, I heard you cite the number of 651. I recall that at the time when Professor Hugh Corder did research for Fini Jinwala, who was then still our speaker, on how many organs of state there are, the Auditor General did a quick search, and he came up with 648 entities. And then you have to add to that, it will be available in the Speaker's office, no doubt, you would have to add to that all the entities under the PMFA and the municipal equivalent, where such entities are not also organs of state, and therefore you will be adding another couple of hundred at least. So firstly, there is a quantity consideration. But secondly, there's a consideration about applicability. Why use the organs of state definition when the reason that the organ of state definition was made is essentially an administrative justice consideration? It was because at that time the states, all modern states, had begun to relinquish power to parastatals, increasingly functions that governments used to be responsible for went to parastatals, and increasingly they were constructed in business terms like corporations. But they still held public power, especially where they were monopolies. And it was felt that they should not be able to divest themselves of the obligation to act with administrative justice, therefore with in a procedurally fair, lawful, and reasonable way. They are still accountable to the public. And the question there was, are they also therefore accountable to Parliament? It was a consideration under Section 55 of the Constitution. Who do we hold to account? It's an administrative justice provision, and Professor Yvonne Byrne in administrative law described, made the point that a Section 239 organ, like the law societies or the universities, although they don't fall within the hierarchy of any State Department, their functions are public powers and perform public functions only to the degree that they derive their powers from legislation. Universities each have a statute, but they are still independent institutions. So do the CSIR, the HSRC. I mean, the law society, you don't want to tangle with the law, the legal profession. Why should this law, the secrecy law, be applicable to those bodies, the universities, the law societies, anybody, the Chapter 9, anybody that exists under a statute or who exercises some form of public power? You see, and as things stand, the myth does in fact apply to them. And it doesn't make any sense. Why are we classifying state secrets in bodies that don't perform such functions? That is why we like to argue that we should ask ourselves the question, what is it we want to classify? Which departments would it apply to? And surely, at the end of the day, there are only two or three or four departments of state, in the classic sense, that really need to classify documents in the interest of national security, instead of the entire 650 organs of state, and that count was done before the year 2000, so there would be more now.
Before I get to the Honourable Lawrence, perhaps to remind you, Honourable Smith, in a very nice way, the bill is targeting two particular aspects of information. The one thing that is targeting is the obligation on organs of state to protect information from certain bad things. And surely, you're not going to object if the bill is saying to your organs of state that they need to protect that information from being lost, altered, or from being destroyed, because if the organ of state didn't take that precaution, then your rights under PIA is worth nothing. But the day you come to look for the information, you might find that it has been lost or destroyed or whatever. So it's not a secrecy bill, and that's why it hasn't been called a secrecy bill. It's been called a Protection of Information Act. It's not a secrecy bill as such, because it's got the two particular aspects, the one that I'm saying, and the other one that you are relying on now is the aspect of the power to classify, which we spoke about yesterday. It's really a power. Okay. If you, it doesn't matter how many organs of state there are, we don't have to go and count them, or perhaps that is your view, but we don't have to count them. If they have something secret there that needs to be classified, then they should. This bill will give them the power to classify it. I can understand you say, well, you know, they might not know whether they're an organ of state, but those are those grey areas in law where people go to court and entities have to find out whether they are indeed an organ of state as envisaged, or whether the bill in fact does apply to them. I thought I'd just mention that the bill is not, it's not a secret bill. Not just dealing with secret or classified information, it is dealing in general with information in government's hands, that information needs to be protected. It's a follow-up on what I said.
Okay. Two sentences, just to say that we do so object. We do think it is not the business of the intelligence ministry and its legislative function to deal with, to be the filing clerks of the nation and to look after so-called valuable information. Why should the intelligence ministry tell everybody how to look after their documentation? The information regulator being created under the other information bill will have the function of inspecting the security, but of electronic databases, because it's important that some government, all except the intelligence and security ones, it's important that state, the government departments look after their information properly for the sake of the privacy of the citizen. It's a different rationale. We do precisely object to all of those sections of the bill, entire chapters that deal with valuable information, how you file, how you look after your stuff. What does that got to do with national security and the intelligence ministry?
So, if it was the Department of Justice that was assigned this duty, do I understand you correct, you would not have an objection?
Public administration, perhaps, and then still just government departments.
But you do see a need for the protection against loss, destruction.
Do you need to write a law? I'm not convinced you do. No.
I just want to, are you conceding there is a need?
The myth is about safes and locks and this
I'm trying to understand where you are coming from. You say that state security intelligence people shouldn't be in charge of this particular bill.
You know, pure administration.
But looking just at the one particular aspect of the bill where there is the obligation to protect the information in the state's hands from being destroyed, from being lost, or from being altered, do you have a problem if some other department were to be in charge of that particular aspect? Or do you, in principle, have an objection that that information shouldn't be protected in the manner that
it's
envisaged?
It is one of the catastrophic aspects of some South African administration. We know what's happened in Home Affairs. I would dearly like to see every State Department look properly after my information and the information of all my fellow citizens. And our information regulator will do some of that stuff. But whether it's the Department of Public Administration who does it, whether you do it by way of policy, but we're talking about State Departments there. And precisely the Section 239 comes into play again. I mean, we're going to legislate for the universities and the law societies to tell them how to look after their documents.
I'm trying to ascertain so that we are clear if we are going to do something about it, that we understand what it is you're saying. So you do concede that this information needs to be protected from those nasty things.
But this is
not disclosure. We're not dealing with disclosure now. I'm just dealing with when you come for your birth certificate, you'd like to find it there. When you come for your driver's license, you don't want to find it's been altered.
Absolutely, but it is not the function of the intelligence department.
Okay, so but if it was justice, you wouldn't have an objection.
No,
but you
do
say in principle
public
that
administration
in principle
government.
Those things need to be protected.
Yes, whether by law is another
question. We understand you. Honourable Landers. Honourable Landers, it's your turn.
Thank you. For a moment, I thought you were going to conduct this debate just yourself and two honourable members. Significantly, and we must appreciate your intervention, Chip. Significantly, PAIA doesn't have a schedule that Mr. Mania is demanding. Now, if there's a piece of legislation that should have a schedule of organs of state, it's PAIA, yes. No, I'm not asking you to answer me. I'm simply stating a fact, all right? We listen to you very quietly, with respect and courtesy. Do the same to me, please. Now, PAIA does not have a schedule. And if there's a piece of legislation that should have a schedule of organs of state, it is PAIA, yes. The Constitution doesn't have a schedule of organs of state.
Please. Honorable Smuts, please.
The schedule, the Constitution does not have a schedule of organs of state. Now, Chairperson, the Democratic Alliance refers to people like the law societies and universities. And if a myth applies to them, it would be interesting to know whether the authority is responsible for the implementation of myths actually exercise their power over those institutions. Now, your knowledge of the law societies and some of our knowledge of universities tells us that if ever that happens, I mean, there would be an uproar. There would be an uproar. And the same applies to the protection of information. So let us see how it works. The Honorable Dean Smuts concedes someone has to be responsible for it. And in their view, it shouldn't be the Minister of Intelligence or State Security or not the spook. But someone must be. So someone in state,
Honorable Landers, let me just get the debate and what's next. Honorable Smuts, please. When I, if Mr. Lan, Honorable Lan, had interfered when you were talking, I would have likewise interfered.
Okay.
I think the people behind us trying to follow the arguments here, it's getting interesting. So let the Honorable Lan talk. Honorable Lan, can we hear? No, you see, that's where your problem begins. You intervene so often that you begin to lose what I'm saying. You see? And it's wishful thinking on your part. If you say that I seem to be supporting you, and we understand the mandate you've come here with. So the people sitting here have come to hear you actually put forward that mandate. We understand that. Well, 3 million voters, there you go. You've answered Dean Smuts. Well done, David. As regards to the information regulator, Chairperson, we'll need to look at that. My information is somewhat different, but let's look at that. But the point I'm making here is we find it so odd that in legislation that actually deals with access to information, there is no schedule. Yes, there is no schedule. There is no schedule. Go and look at PAYA and look at PAYA and find, tell me where in PAYA there is a schedule of organs of state. Well, hello? You whisper that. You don't need one. No. Why didn't we need one when I served on justice? When PAYA was considered, why didn't we need a schedule of organs of state? No. In the same way that there's no need for a schedule here, if David Mania or the Democratic Alliance wants a schedule of organs of state, then let them go to the Treasury, or to the Auditor General, or to the PM's Committee, and the Speaker's Office, and you'll get a schedule. No, you are saying we must put it in the law, or that Mr. Daniels must give it to you. We are saying no, it's not his responsibility. As a member of Parliament, you have access to that information. Go and get it. Honourable members, sir, that seems to be a factual thing. I've got the full PAYA here with the regulations. Anybody who wishes sometime during these proceedings to look at it may do so. But I also don't see a schedule there. And common sense will tell you there can't be one, for the very reason that we are hearing in the opinion that these things are volatile. There are some that are quite clearly that we know, and there are some that come up today but don't exist tomorrow. And there are some that the courts might feel, because of the powers that they exercise and the functions that they exercise, should in fact, where they de facto might not be, but de jure, in law, as in terms of the various court decisions, might be regarded as organs of state, even though it might clearly not look like that. I think we're going to leave that. We're still on the same topic, the Honourable Lander.
Chair, I just wanted the Honourable Lander to clear up his position, because it seems to me, after a lot of huffing and puffing, his argument is that we ought to get a schedule, but that it's not the state law advisor's responsibility to provide us with the schedule. I'm not clear. Honourable Londers doesn't want the schedule. But the point, let me make an argument.
Are you sending you on a wild goose chase? He's sending you to look for something you're not going to find.
Well, Chair, can I just... The Honourable Smuts has made the democratic argument about why it is we need to look into the scope of this bill. But there's an administrative argument also. If this bill applies to 600 or 700 institutions, it raises the question about whether the state, in the form of the state security department, will have the capacity to implement the book. And that's something we have a duty to interrogate. Because, if you recall, the ISS submission during the public hearings cited Auditor General's reports, which showed that the Department of State Security could not look after their own documents, let alone the documents of 648 organs of state. That's the first point. The second point is the scope of the bill also is directly relevant to the financial implications of implementing this bill. If indeed the scope of the bill includes 648 institutions, then the Department of State Security is, if it's going to comply with at least Section 35 of the PFMA, is going to have to inform us in respect of each province, for example, where MIF is implemented, where it is not implemented, and where it is not implemented, they are going to have to provide us with not only a schedule of the institutions, but also an estimate of the cost. So this is unavoidable.
Honourable Mania, on the question of the intelligence community not being able to look after their documents, you see the only way you can protect secrecy is to allow for penalties. You can call your document as secret as you want to, top secret, very top secret. It's not going to help you if you can't punish the people that distribute that document unlawfully. That's particularly the problem that exists in the intelligence community now. And we will concede that the major part of classified documentation will be in that area, but it doesn't follow that that is the only area in which documents would be classified. It's clearly not the case. But one will accept that in that area, most of the documents, and the problem that we have there is that we can't punish the people. So, this is what this process is all about. We need the law and we need it fast. But I don't think that it is correct and fair to say that they can't look after their own documents. You will know more than anybody else. There are other institutions that have similar problems. Honourable Mayne?
The Chair, I think, I mean, I agree with you in at least one respect. The bill will apply in the main to state security departments. But as you say, it will apply to other departments. But then is it not incumbent on our committee and on the legislature to apply our minds and decide to what institutions the bill actually does apply? It's as simple as that. It's not an easy problem. It's probably a difficult problem. But I do think that we have that duty.
I mean, the Honourable Landers and the Honourable Mania have discussed a schedule. The reason why we would like to see a list created by the Chief State Law Advisor and his many, many helpers is to assist you to apply your mind to how, in heaven's name, once you see that list of nearly 1,000 things, how in heaven's name is it appropriate or applicable that national security, which is the subject matter of the bill once we've amended it, why do we want to bring all of these things into the remit? It'll be a way for us as a committee to assist ourselves to see, but which ones of these departments and agencies really are relevant to this bill, to the protection of national security as we are going to define it? Speaking for my part, that's why I would like you to produce a list, because I think it's just inappropriate to make the law applicable to all of these departments. It don't make any sense. National security is what we want to protect. Let's look at the long list, and then in the end we could attach a nice short schedule to the Protection of State Information Bill, which says this bill applies to intelligence. SANDF, I don't know, they've got their own laws, SAPS, I don't know, they've got their own laws, but a few others. But let's look at it properly, and then I think we and then have the debate, and we undertake to listen. And I would predict that at the end of the day we would ditch the definition organ of state and maybe go to Section 238, which is about the executive organs of state, which is really what the miss concerns.
Honourable Smash, I think we exhausted the getting, but I see you're now trying to put the thing on me. And I must produce a list. I'm not very sorry. I refuse to get involved in that argument. Yes, the Honourable Fisher.
As a layman, you know, the law applies to everyone if he commits an offense. If you commit murder, anybody, it applies to him. So that we can't say that we need to have a schedule of particular organs of state that it applies to. If it's an offense, it's an offense to everybody. If he has committed an offense against the law, then he has to punish it, no matter what organ it belongs to, as long as it is an offense. That's what I mean.
Yes, Mr. Daniels.
Thank you, Chair. I'm obviously not getting involved in the debate at all. I'm just the website. But Chair Corson, I do want to take you back to the original version of the bill, which talks about the application of the Act. And you'll see that provision is made to exemption. I wonder if that doesn't address the concerns, because I have heard the DA raise that issue on a number of occasions, but it seems that the debate has progressed so far that we're losing sight of some of the provisions in the original bill. And as far as I'm aware, this committee has not yet tampered with clause 3 of the original bill, which deals with the application of the Act. And so that allows, the reality is there is a debate about whether law societies are organs of state or not. It would be very interesting if they are, because it would mean that the public protector, for example, can investigate him, can investigate complaints against him, all kinds of interesting things arise, and I don't want to enter into that terrain at the moment. Then, Chairperson, it's perhaps also necessary to point out that municipalities have a green paper system which restricts information and to which very severe penalties are attached to, where councillors, for example, breach all of that. I'm not certain whether they do that in terms of legislation or not, but there is a wider range of organizations which are currently using a system of classification. And it seems what this bill tries to do is in fact to harmonize and to prescribe how and when and under what circumstances you need to classify. What that means, for example, in relation to a municipality specifically, is that a municipality can also apply for an exemption. A municipality may feel we want to have everything open, we don't want to classify, we don't want to establish minimum standards, and so they can apply for an exemption to the minister. It seems to me that when we look at some of the issues raised, that we have to look at the provisions of the bill, because possibly they address those concerns. It is, given the opinion we presented, of course there is information available, and some of the information is very easy to give to the committee immediately. But on the basis of the definition, we are going to have to look at so many bodies to determine whether they are in fact organs of state as defined in Section 239. That would be a time-consuming and an almost impossible task, even for an office as well as resources. Thanks.
Honourable Honourable members, that I think concludes the debate on which orbits of state the bill should apply to. It concludes the debate that Mr. Daniels was asked to look at, which was to come up with a list of organs of state. Doesn't conclude the matter. I can see you trying to. I'm not going to hold you to that, Mr. Mania. But I think for today's business, it's not going to take us any further. You want to get into this thing, open it up again. I think we've finished.
Chair, I understand that there are two other questions that you want to move on to deal with, and I think this is probably the appropriate time for you to do that. Safe to say that this does not conclude the debate. I mean, if I could summarize the debate, it seems to me in this committee, you may agree with me, is that nobody is sure.
What I've said is that concludes the debate for today.
But
as was requested from Mr. Daniels to come and present, that matter is now finished on this paper as it stands. We go on to the next issue. We will come back. If you want to open up the debate, and I know you still have further issues on this, you'll get back to that. But if we want to go through the paper while Mr. Daniels is here, we don't want to abuse his presence.
Okay. But you do agree with me, Chair, that nobody in this committee is sure to which bodies this act applies. That's the first point, and that we do not have a schedule.
No, I don't agree with you, but Honourable...
Chairperson, I think the other issue is that we don't really understand the relevance of wanting to have that list and what the DA wants to achieve by having the list. I think the point that Mr. Daniels made about that there are exclusions, opportunity for exclusion, addresses the concern, and therefore why do we need this list? What are we trying to achieve by it?
Honourable Landers.
As a matter of record, we would be opposed to asking Mr. Daniels to produce any kind of schedule, certainly in this case, a schedule of organs of state. Anyone wanting to produce a list of organs of state is welcome to go out and collect it, and they are free to present it to this committee as part of their submission. And the Honourable Dean Smart has said, it's very easy, so if it's so easy, do it. So you know, if the point raised by Mr. Mania about the schedule and the importance of such a schedule, then again we ask, why is there no such schedule prior to our constitution? And for those reasons, we believe it's unnecessary to have such a schedule for this book.
I think that matter has, everybody understands the matter. I made it clear I'm not producing the list myself. And
the different bill with a different purpose. The purpose of this one is something entirely different, and you have to think quite carefully what you allow classification to apply to. The entire raison d'etre of the fire is to give effect to Section 32, which says all information is available to you. So you precisely don't write it.
Okay. Honourable members, we are going to go on. On this particular issue now, Mr. Daniels has made himself clear. It's quite clear from the opinion the difficulties. Those that still find it unclear can remain after this meeting. I will try and make it clearer to them. It's quite clear from their opinion that you are going to be chasing your tail here when you try to come to a final figure of how many organs of state there are. There are matters, as Mr. Daniels has said, that has not been resolved. There are debates around a whole range of institutions. Now, why do we want to be so brave to get involved in that debate here? Daniels has said it's a difficult task. I think I'm going to add it's an impossible task. Therefore, let us not deal with impossible things. We want to deal with things that are possible. So, we will go on to the next part of the opinion, and we can take questions then from the honourable members on the next part of the opinion. Just by way of whether the classifying person, the classifying person in the bill, can be the same person that is the information officer in prior. You say many things here and you quote many sections. Am I to understand you that your recommendation is that it's not advisable? Or where are you really hanging your hat in this, on this one?
Chairperson, quite frankly, it's not me to hang my hat in this committee, because I'm just the state law advisor at that occasion to point out to the Honourable mainly, quite seriously. We are here to try and assist this committee, and so we've given the committee a whole lot of information which ultimately the committee has to analyse and digest and come to a decision. But in short, to answer the question, it is possible for the person who is the information officer who receives a request for access to information to also be the person who classifies information. But we caution that when you do that, you need to be precise in the legislation because of the doctrine of vagueness that is applied. The citizens of this country are entitled to legislation which is clear, unambiguous if possible, and easy to implement and to understand and to access. Thank you.
I take it then it follows from that particular caution that there would have to be certain adjustments made to the bill then to bring about that certainty.
And yes, we do suggest that.
Honourable members?
Just a clarification. I thought that this, and it's been excellently done. Thank you to CISA. But just setting out of the rule of law and the necessity for clarity and precision and so forth, surely that has been given to us in the context of the question whether you should create separate information officers and classification officers. Therefore, that is the point. Well, we find it interesting, by the way, how directly applicable these rule of law requirements are to the debate we've just had, because we cannot precisely pass a law where nobody knows to whom it applies, and you just pass the thing, and then you give the minister discretion to exclude embarrassing categories or institutions as they come up. So you see, what we've just discussed precisely offends the rule of law. It precisely offends Section 1C of the Constitution. But in this context, sir, it appears to apply to the question of the information officer. And I think it's one which I read that judgment which you asked us to read yesterday afternoon, but I didn't have a whole lot of time. It's very interesting. And it does seem to me correct that this is a policy decision. CISA has basically disposed of the legal question, says that this, the ball's in your court, it's a policy decision. And both of us think that there is a problem with potential forum shopping. I mean, sometimes you do need to create more than one body or more than one avenue. It gives greater access. But there clearly are downsides to forum shopping here. So we think the drift of this argument is good, but for myself, I wouldn't want to take a final position on it.
Honourable members? Honourable one?
Chair, I think the opinion is very clear. There will be occasions when the classifying authority also acts as the information officer. Equally, there will be occasions when the classifying officer is not the information officer. And Mr. Daniels' office has warned us that in
answer that situation, there would have to be a conferring by the two parties. It's a difficult situation, particularly where they warn that persons who do not have the requisite security clearance may have cited documents that are classified. That's where the difficulty lies. So, you know, in that situation, but the office of Mr. Daniels has pointed out that in that situation, care needs to be exercised. And so we would need to decide, I'm not sure why we need to decide that the classifying officer must also be the information officer or vice versa. Is it necessary for us to take such a decision? I think we can put into this bill the necessary caution and boundaries and then take it from there.
We need Honourable Honours to look at the possibilities and being the same person came as a consequence of wanting to use or considering to use PIA as the sole act through which information would be applied for access. So you would then have an information officer that would consider your request, and because the bill was providing that the person that classifies be the head of an organ of state, we were just wondering whether the likelihood is that it could well be the same person. And if it was the same person, what would be the consequences? That's how the debate came around, whether there would be anything wrong if they were the same person. Yes,
I don't think there's anything wrong if they're the same person. I think it makes life easier for all concerned. I think the difficulty will arise is when they're not the same. And then if one of them doesn't have the requisite security clearance, then your difficulty becomes even greater. But if it's the same person, then it's a piece of cake. That person then applies his mind both as an information officer in terms of fire and as the classifying authority in terms of protection of information.
Honourable Mayne. Sorry.
I mean, on the face of it, I would tend to want to agree with that until we've thought it through fully. But it is attractive, and it solves one of the problems that the Supreme Court of Appeal cites in the judgment, doesn't it? They pointed to the problem that the information officer will not have direct knowledge of the facts justifying the secrecy. And, of course, we have a culture of justification now. So if your classifying officer is your information officer, that is remedied. So on the face of it, it seems what Mr. Lawless had argued seems to be the solution to a problem raised also by the Supreme Court of Appeal. So, I mean, provisionally, as far as I'm concerned, we can go in that direction, but we must be sure that we've thought all of it through.
Mr. Lawless?
Just qualify that, Chair. I'm not for any moment suggesting that it must be the same. What I'm saying is they could be the same.
That's what I understood you.
Yes, yes, but you see, other people may read me differently and say, okay, he is saying that the bill must say they must be the same. That's not what I'm saying. They can be the same, but you will have a situation where they're not the same.
The can you help me on this one, that think this one through when you say in this opinion that PIA was never intended to be the sole source through which access to information would be sought by the public. I understand what you're saying here, that Parliament, if necessary, could make additional laws which will also allow for access to information. And I'm sure there are ones that exist already that allow for access to information in some way or another. But on what you say here, forget the ones that might be in existence now. This one that you now, this relating to laws that are still to be made, can you help me through that one? If I were, for example, to argue with you, and not very strongly, I might say, that the Constitution intended that a law be made to give effect to the right to access to information. And that the Constitution went as far as setting out just how that law should look in a very broad sense. Does that mean that Parliament can have more than one go at the particular constitutional directive? The Constitution is going to make a law to give effect to this thing and take into account some of these things. Can Parliament have more than one go at that particular directive?
Chairperson, I'll ask my colleague Makabeni to also deal with the issue. But the original bill before this committee did precisely that. It said to the world at large, if it's going to be passed, that you can request access to information in terms of the Protection of Information Act, well, the bill. Or alternatively, it said you can request access to information in terms of clause 28 of the bill. And so we had a dual system there. What we're cautioning, of course, is that we should make it clear that you choose one or the other. And you don't have one go at the cherry in terms of the provision of information bill and then try it again under the promotion of access to information bill. And at the time, we were mindful of the fact that you could perhaps use both to try and get information. But we didn't think that it was a problem. But given the sort of debate that has arisen, we now caution that you may want to make it one or the other avenue through which to gain access to information. But I'll hand you over, Chairperson, to Mr. Makabeni. Perhaps he'd like to add to it.
Thank you, Chair. The import of that statement, Chair, is that we are saying PAIA does not prohibit organs of state from granting access through other pieces of legislation. Not necessarily that you can now go and provide for access in other future pieces of legislation. Let's say, for instance, the Home Affairs piece of legislation. Should I continue talking, sir?
He was trying to do something honorable, though the consequences were. He was trying to do something to the aircon. Unfortunately, yes, continue.
There's a piece of legislation that allows you to get, for instance, your identity document. PAIA doesn't prevent you from going through that piece of, for state organs from granting you your information through that piece of legislation. Now, Section 6 of PAIA provides that nothing in PAIA prevents the giving of access to a record of a public body in terms of any legislation referred to in Part 1 of the schedule to PAIA, or a record of a public body in terms of any legislation referred to in Part 2 of that schedule. And then there's also Section 5, which provides that PAIA applies to the exclusion of any provision of other legislation that prohibits or restricts the disclosure of a record. So any legislation that would provide for access to a record it would be overridden by this provision, by Section 5 of PAYA, if it prohibits or restricts access by Section 5 of PAYA. So it would create a confusion if there is a conflict between the two provisions. But if there is no conflict, then it is fine. I don't know if I made it clear.
I think my question was directed to more to the Constitution, not to PAYA. What PAYA says. My question was directed where the Constitution says, look, you can have in the fundamental rights sections, you've got this right of access. Now, Parliament makes a law to give effect to this right and take into account these things. So we go as Parliament and we make that law. Does the Constitution contemplate, forget other laws that might have existed in the past before this, does the Constitution contemplate, or can one read into the Constitution, that one can enact a law like PAYA and another law like the Protection of Information Bill, also to allow for access? Does the Constitution not say it does? Can one read into that there's nothing wrong with that? So it's not where the PAYA, it's more whether the Constitution is not prohibiting that by inference or by implication. You know the terms, you know. It's not a problem that I'm trying to protect. It's not an argument I'm trying to protect. I just want to hear more thinking on the point. You know, what is your thinking on that point? Because if the thinking is that, well, there is nothing wrong, access to classified information can be legislated in this way, that would then mean that in the future there could be other possible pieces of legislation that could also deal with access, because the Constitution in itself does not prohibit, as long as the right to access is not interfered with in a manner that is contemplated by Section 36, which is the clause that justifies an intrusion on the right. So perhaps, you know, when you say that PAYA does not prohibit access, it was not from the PAYA side that I was looking, but more from the constitutional side.
Perhaps I agree with this. You see, the Constitution in terms of Section 32 doesn't prevent more than one piece of legislation from regulating access to information. The only qualification is that it would have to be national legislation. In other words, legislation passed by this Parliament. But let me just draw a comparison between a totally different section. If you look at the chapter under security services, for example, in section 119.192, it says the Defence Force is the only lawful military force in the Republic. What that means is that the Constitution says that any other military formation which is established would be unlawful. Just to draw a comparison, the Constitution in section 32 doesn't contain any provision restricting us from passing other legislation to regulate. And that is why, Chairperson, I indicated to you that the Promotion of Access to Information Bill, which we looked at some time ago, before we proposed these changes, or rather before the committee proposed the changes, in fact takes into consideration the fact that this Parliament can pass national legislation which would also regulate access.
The point then you make on Mr. Daniels is that it's the fundamental point that unless it is expressly stated or can be clearly inferred, that it doesn't exist then. So it's not excluded expressly, nor can one infer. You say one cannot infer from this that prior was to be, or that there was only to be one law, that Parliament only had one go at this access to information. That's basically what you're saying. Am I correct?
That is what we are saying, and that's what my colleague Mr. Makubeni indicated to you as well, Chairman. Thank you.
Well, Marimas, I hope you understand the argument. Yes, Sam.
Could I just reiterate what is our position? The PAYA is the law required by Section 72.2. It was required to be written by February of 2000. It was so written. And then any law that we now do subsequently should fit, as we have put it, like a puzzle piece with the PAYA. That doesn't mean there can't be adjustments, but it's a PAYA is the law that gives effect to 32.2, because 32.2 is what you call an internal limitation. It says we give you unfettered access to information in the hands of the state. But it is recognized that there will be administrative and financial implications, and therefore national legislation must be written which limits the unfettered right so that it doesn't become an impossible burden on the state. And the PAYA is that thing. The PAYA is that thing, and therefore the PAYA has its Section 5, which says any law which restricts information more than PAYA is not kosher. The PAYA prevails. You can't restrict information more tightly than the PAYA does.
In legal circles, some of what you said would be regarded as unsound.
But, I invite you to read the General Counsel of the Bar.
But we are mindful of the fact that we are not in a court of law. But we must always remember that rights in the Bill of Rights, particularly even the right to access to information, can be limited by Section 36.
Shall we take the submission by the General Counsel of the Bar under review?
Honourable members, while the honourable members are busy thinking, Mr. Daniels, what is the position with the Bruma case? So is the time period thing that Constitutional Court held. Where are we with that thing? Because I didn't see that thing come here yet.
Because the Constitutional Court, in fact, read in that the period should be extended, and so extended it. Although Parliament can still amend that. But in the Bruma case, they decided that the 30-day period mentioned was unconstitutional because it was too short. So that relates to the appeal.
Are we going to amend? Because the Constitutional Court says that if there's no Parliament doesn't intervene, it will be deemed to be amended to read 180 days, I think.
That's already in effect.
Is 18...
But what the Constitutional Court said is Parliament can still amend the clause if it so wishes, or rather the section if it so wishes.
It's just a bit of discussion, but the Bruma case was a case that started, I think, in the Cape Provincial Court, where Bruma took the Minister of Social Development to court. Under PAYA, there was an appeal that was lodged under PAYA, and the appeal had been rejected because the time period in which the appeal should have been lodged had lapsed. That was the 30 days thing which is in PAYA. The applicant lost here and went on appeal eventually to the Constitutional Court, which held that those sections, I think it's 78 something of the PAYA, was unconstitutional. And that Parliament should change it. And if Parliament didn't change it within 18 months, it would be deemed to read 180 days or something. It was just time periods. But court was unhappy with that the requester was given far too little time to exercise his right, and that the fact that he had to ask for condemnation was unnecessary because the right should have been that he had much more time to apply for the information or to take the matter on appeal. Honourable members, on their opinion.
Well, I think what we must do is rather focus on the opinion, because at some later stage we'll engage with Dean Smuts's view that access to information is unfettered. So that's another debate on it. Yes, and sections of PIA say you do not have. Sections of PIA say you may not have that information. Yes, but sections of PIA say you will not receive certain information. So it can't be unfettered if PIA says certain information is not accessible to you. You said all information is unfettered. You said access is unfettered. Well, PIA says something else. Read PIA. Section 33, 34, 35, etc. says you may not have this information. Now, if you are saying access is unfettered, why does PIA say this? Chairperson, my own view, which I haven't canvassed with yourself and others, is that protection of information shouldn't be the instrument for access. The instrument for access to information is PIA, and if in its wisdom at some later stage Parliament feels there should be other instruments to provide for that access, then so be it. That's my own personal view. So essentially then what we're saying is a requester will make a request to the information officer, and if the information requested doesn't fall within the ambit of those clauses or sections in PIA that can be automatically refused, the information officer will consider whether that information must be granted. In doing so, the information officer will determine that this information is actually being classified from the secret. The information officer will approach the classifying authority as to whether this information can be made available. If the classifying authority says no, he or she will then provide reasons why that is the case. The information officer will convey that information to the requester, and in terms of the protection of information, both he or she has the right to say to the relevant person, please declassify this information. That is my understanding of the process as it will evolve. I see nothing wrong with that. Somehow there's a feeling that there must be a marrying of ways. I don't see why. And the requester's request for declassification of information is not automatically granted. The classifying authority will apply his or her mind. And if it's refused, as I understand the bill at presently, there's a process of appeals that's put in place. So they have.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we are busy with now. We are busy looking at, you know, access being dealt with by PIA and protection being dealt with by the bill. That's where we ended last year, looking at whether PIA shouldn't be the sole piece of legislation through which access, in this instance, is used by a requester, including requesting the information that has been protected in the book, including that you solely use PIA for that. That's what we are trying to do. That's what we have asked Mr. Daniels to look at. Some of the problems that we've looked at is, can the requester then be, can the information officer be the same person that classified Those were some of the more problematic things that came up. But it is, in fact, to look at that, whether we can have one system, as you put it, through which access is applied for. Honourable members, it seems that you have... this thing seems not to be working. I can see the Honourable Mania is leaning more to back and back. You might... Others are leading more forward and more forward. This aircon is just not working today. Honourable members, is that it? If we are going to be rounding off so early today, the issue is what are we going to be doing tomorrow? I would like to think that the key business is going to be dealt with on Tuesday. We won't meet on Monday, but on Tuesday. I would like to give the Honourable Dean Smuts the opportunity to deal with the argument of which we have heard quite a large portion today. We'll hear you on Tuesday on that. And we, if I might be given permission to liaise with Mr. Enver's office just on some of the consequential things that we haven't raised here, perhaps there will be a need for him to come back on some of the issues, but I don't want to define and what's the name that if committee could just give me that permission to look, and perhaps we can still get some clarity on some of the matters. The idea why I don't want us to meet tomorrow is I would like the committee members now to take what is the crux of this bill, and that is the harmonizing the thing with BIO. We have heard a whole range of arguments now, a whole range of opinions to assist us in coming to conclusions, coming on which way we want to go and which way we should go. So, you're going to get tomorrow and the weekend to read through all these things, to apply your mind. I know it is very strenuous to sit here day after day and then you start to lose the essence of the stuff. And then when the weekend comes, you go recuperate yourself and you come back the next day and say, the next week and say, I didn't say that. And you start all new arguments, you know, and then we go on and on. I think we reach the stage where the honourable members have got sufficient in their minds, and they need to go and process that stuff. If I put too much more in your mind, you're going to come here and then we're going to be going in circles. So can we agree we will not meet tomorrow? For the very reason that there is a lot for you to consider. Go and speak to your lawyers. Go and speak to your experts. Come back on Tuesday fully equipped, where we will finally debate this thing of PIA, and then we are going to go back to the beginning to see how we are going to proceed to finalize this bill. Whether it's going to take us 1 week or 1 month or 1 year, as the Honourable Dean Smuts suggested, we will assess that next Tuesday. Can we agree on those things, Honourable Members? Honourable members, then we will adjourn. Then Mr. Daniels, can I just see you before this meeting is going to adjourn?